Could say now very confidently that Or Torah is a shul without a microphone. No question. Okay. On Sunday.
Okay. So Bishop the Mor Dasa Rabbi Engel.
All right. Bishop Rabbi Engel the Mor Dasa, our host. And everyone here, it's an honor and a privilege to join with you this morning. Many friends of the Kollel of Yeshiva University. It's a distinct pleasure to share this morning with, I would say, the extended hosts of this Shabbos, Congregation Or Torah, as well as Kehilat Chovei Tzion. We are delighted that Rabbi Gelman and Rabbi Engel, Rabbi Ehrenfeld are here. In addition to other distinguished personalities, Rabbi Biber, I see Rabbi Eisenberg from the Religious Zionists, and many other friends. I want to make a special note to welcome Mrs. Esther Joel. Thank you for coming all this way. Delighted you're here for Shabbos. As well as two other special individuals who've made put in a lot of effort. That one is our executive director of our Kollel, Yitzi Matanki, and another one is the special guest, Alan Sector. Alan, where are you? Just a hand. We lost him. He was here. But he's a very special individual, and if you have the chance to greet him and have the opportunity to welcome him, that would be certainly most appropriate. So this morning we have a special opportunity to welcome three leaders to discuss an important topic in our community. And these three individuals have a significant amount to share on this topic from different vantage points, both in terms of their personal backgrounds, but also in terms of their connection. Each one has a connection to Yeshiva University, which is the host of this weekend, and to Chicago, to our community. So the first speaker, the distinguished president and Brabham Family University professor at Yeshiva University, President Richard M. Joel. So he has obviously a connection to Yeshiva University. That's where he's been the president. And he caught on to that since 2003. But really, by way of introduction, it's important to note that our kolel, the Yeshiva University Torah Mitzion Kolel, would not exist. And no YU kolelim in any form or fashion. There are two kolelim like ours, and in Toronto, and there are a bunch of school-based models. None of that would exist without the investment and the vision and the support of Yeshiva University, of the Center for the Jewish Future, of Rabbi Isaac Elkanah Theological Seminary, and ultimately, President Richard Joel. It was years ago that he understood the imperative of bringing the mission and the vision of Yeshiva Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elkanan, of Yeshiva University, of all that YU represents, and sharing it with communities. Communities like ours, right here in Chicagoland, in Skokie, in Lincolnwood, in Northbrook, and everything that the Kolel reaches. And the Kolel benefits enormously, immensely, from many in-kind services from Yeshiva University, specifically from CJF and REITs, in terms of shiurim classes, HR support. We can't say enough, and I couldn't personally say enough, to be makir tov to President Joel and to YU for what they've done for our kolel and for our community, looking around at the alumni of Yeshiva and of REITs who are here. So President Joel, for those who do not know, before he became the president of Yeshiva University, he was the international director of Hillel. Before that, he served as an attorney. He has a connection to Chicago, not just that this is not his first visit here, but he has many relationships and important strategic relationships and has continued to build those in the network of yeshiva here and around the country. Maran Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz Shlita also, I would say, has both of those relationships. On the one hand, he has been our, so to speak, spiritual leader in our community for now over 25 years, but he has a very special relationship with yeshiva, not just because last year he was recognized by REITs at the Chag HaSmicha, but because, believe it or not, the year that he received ordination in an oral bechina from the great Gaonim, Rav Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik, Rav Moshe Shatzkis, and Rav Dr. Belkin, Zichronim Levracha, was the year 1949. And it is a great honor and a great kavod that each year when we bring new families for the kolel, every year we have an orientation, we have a Kabbalah's panim with Rav Schwartz at the Basin, and to see the Masorah being transmitted alive in our own community in Chicago, for Rav Schwartz to describe to our Chavri HaKolel what it meant to be connected to that world of yeshiva in the 1940s, and to bring that into our world, our community, and our day, it's bridging those two worlds for all of us, and it's in real time, here and now. And finally, Rav Yonah Reis, as Rav Schwartz is our Rosh Besdin, now we are delighted to have Rabbi Yonah Reis serve as the Av Besdin of the Chicago Rabbinical Council and its affiliated Besdin. Rabbi Reis, also a, I would say, a lot of lawyers.
We're in recovery.
Is also a former lawyer, so to speak, but now in a different area on Jewish law. Rabbi Reis has served not just in various capacities in New York in different ways, but specifically before coming to Chicago, he was the Menahel, he was the dean of Rabbi Isaac Elkanah Theological Seminary, and now has brought that professionalism, that expertise, that knowledge, all of that to bear in our Chicago community. So what could be a better way to talk about important issues of our day than with three of the major leaders of our Jewish community? So without any further ado, we have a few questions to address in terms of the general topic, the topic we're focusing on today, which is machlokas, differences of opinion in our community. So I actually wanted to begin with President Joel to share with some, because not everybody here is familiar with the nature of yeshiva, and how if you talk about the notion of different perspectives within one institution, within one movement, within one community, in a certain sense, yeshiva, yeshiva university, REITs, and its all of its satellites, its world, it is a microcosm of that concept. So perhaps President Joel could speak just initially about what it means to have and to have continued to maintain a thriving community where you have a multiplicity of different views.
Thank you, Rabbi Grand, Patricia Rav. As you will soon see, this is completely unrehearsed. And it's my honor to be here. I also have to put in one more advertisement. Although we have given Rabbi Reis as a gift to this community. He remains Rosh Yeshiva Reis. Once a month he's at Yeshiva. He's teaching in the Yadin Yadin program. And we all look to him as the future in a major way of kind of the poster child of what we all believe in, which is someone who lives a life of shleimut, of wholeness, an integrated life based on Torah, with a unique capacity to explain both the purposes of certain non-negotiables and the ability to apply the timeless values of Torah to our world and to tomorrow. And he would be quick to say that if he is that way, it's because he learned it from Schwartz Schlita, who I'm very grateful for, was willing to join us, and he's always just been so incredibly helpful. A moment of history, when we started the Kollel, as you might understand, it wasn't simply a slam dunk that everybody would say, boy, that's what we need, as opposed to Nacha Kollel. and I was here for a Shabbos, an extended weekend, to go with a few firm believers to talk about what this would be. And Schwartz was incredibly gracious to me and to my wife in welcoming us. But we also went for part of the Shabbos to a shul I won't identify because fortunately I don't remember the name. But it was a shul that would not always open its arms to the yeshiva mentality, although they've been very supportive and they're wonderful people. But clearly the president of Yeshiva University was not someone who you would think they would welcome. And I was there for Shalosh Shuvos, and I was there with Rav Schwartz, who asked if he could introduce me. And he introduced himself as an alumnus of Yeshiva University and a musmach of Yeshiva, introduced me as his president, turned to me and said, there hasn't been such a crowd here since Ne'ila, and had warned me that this particular shul had a slogan, Tyra is the Iker. Tyra is the Iker. And I walked in there, and they looked, and I was Begili Rosh. I was only wearing a yarmulke. And they looked at me. They were very polite to me, because I'm sure they're polite people, but also because Schwartz was my host. And I started by saying, let me break the ice and say the unmentionable. I know you're concerned about yeshiva in this community, and I'm sure you wonder, ultimately, what is it that yeshiva believes? I said, I want you to know what we really stand for. What Yeshiva University believes is Torah is the Iker. There was a moment of silence, there was laughter, and we had a wonderful conversation. But I must tell you that it's that combination of modesty, commitment, and daring that makes Rav Schwartz, unfortunately, an Ein Eitzaka in our world. And I hope you treasure every moment and take full advantage of it. It's on your resume. And it's good to note that your alumni dues are paid up. So, look, when we were talking about doing this, there's something on my mind. I don't have answers, but I have important questions. And you phrased it nicely in talking about yeshiva. So, there is no university that isn't fraught with disagreement. Hopefully. Because hopefully we want young people and thinkers to challenge each other about thoughts and ideas. Yeshiva is a little different than most chaval for most of them, because the core of yeshiva is Torah is the Iker. The core of yeshiva is that we are part of a world and part of a Torah world where we believe that our Torah and our halacha and our relationship with the Rabbanu Shalom is something that makes our days noble or kodesh. That the beauty of the human is to be mekadesh l'chol. To take what's regular, sprinkle magic dust on it, and it becomes kodesh. And we live that way. And I think that's the role of YU. Needless to say, there aren't two people who agree on how to do that. And that's okay. But what I hear more and more is not the passion of argument, but the snarls of fighting. That, as I put it, we have forgotten, if we ever knew, how to disagree agreeably. And along with that comes a loss of civility. And when there's a loss of civility, there's a loss of civilization. And community today is difficult because the culture of community, which is, by the way, reflected on the culture of all other campuses, which is why your children have to come to YU, the culture of community these days is about the individual and not about community. It's about a certain relativism instead of a pluralism that means tolerance, that we're allowed to disagree agreeably. It's about a casualness of relationship, and it's about a community that speaks through typing on iPads instead of from the soul of communication and song. And that makes it hard. And I believe we all bear some responsibility for, number one, understanding our core principles. Number two, being willing to make those principles comprehensible. And number three, being willing to decide that you think someone is completely wrong, but that means that what they believe in that thing is wrong, it doesn't mean that they are of less than worth. And Richard Nixon, who I don't usually quote, but since it was written by, I forget his name, but a famous Jewish speechwriter, in his inaugural said the following. William Safire. He said, "We cannot listen to one another until we stop shouting at one another, until we speak quietly enough so that our words can be heard as well as our voices." And the notion of yeshiva, the notion of our community, and I'll finish with this, is in fact a big tent. It is in fact a big tent where we all swim in the sea of Torah. Many of us swim to somewhat distant destinations, but that sea of Torah, I'm mixing metaphors, in a big tent is a very healthy thing. There's only one hard reality, which is that big tent has limits, has boundaries, has poles of demarcation. And if it doesn't have that, it's simply a tarpaulin that falls upon itself. And everything isn't necessarily in that big tent. Things outside that tent might have great worth, but they're not in that tent. And we have to relate to it and respect it. But the notion of today, that by definition everything has to be in the same tent, is a correctness that can be very difficult to live with. I also will say that we have to differentiate between ideas and how they're expressed. And I would respectfully say that people who express ideas that might be right, when they clothe them in anger or bad descriptions, undermine those very ideas. And that's what we all have to commit ourselves to. Thank you.
Could Rebbe talk a little bit about the experience of machlokas, the concept of differing views, maybe within the Rav's perception of yeshiva, when the Rav was in yeshiva, people would say maybe today it's different. What were things like in those days in terms of the multiplicity of personalities and viewpoints?
First of all, I'd like to make the following statement, which is actually a quote. The question is there an isur, just like you have halachic parameters, guidelines, and how you conduct yourself, is there a prohibition on making a machlokes? So if you look in the Rambam Sefer HaMitzvos, you won't find such a thing. If you look in the Sefer HaMitzvos, Gadol, known as the Sma'at, from the Moshe Kusi, who was one of the Baal Tesis in the medieval times, you don't find such a reference to a mitzvah, but there's another Rishon who was from the Baal Tesis of Yankov of Korbeil, who wrote a sefer called Sefer Mitzvahs Kot, known as the Smak. There in the Smak, he has, and I took the trouble a little jotting down the language that he has in Simen Kuf Lamed Beis, where he enumerates, according to his understanding, what are the mitzvahs I say and the mitzvahs Moses say. The positive mitzvahs and those that are prohibitory. So he writes the following. So first of all, there's a pasuk. Lo yir kekeirach v'adosa. There's a pasuk, the phrase for the pasuk, each person should not be like Korach. In the Chumash, there's a whole seder where that was rebellion against the kahuna, against the priesthood, what we call the priesthood, kahuna. So first he spells it out the following. There's a law, a prohibition, shalom over ala kahuna. You can't challenge a person, why is a kahuna, or to say a kahuna has to be disregarded. I mean, that's what happened in modern times, so-called modern times, where both reform and conservative, up to extent, got rid of kahuna. You don't have to observe the rites of kahuna or whatever it is. So that pasuk says, "Lo yir kekei v'adoso." However, he says, "Uveklal zeh," included into this principle, "Shelo yagzik b'machlekes." A person should not hold on or keep hold of a machlekes. And "Velo yir baal machlekes." A person should not be considered as someone who's always making machlekes. I think in all our Jewish communities, there's always somebody. My experience in the rabbinate, you know, since 1949, I got smicha, and shortly after I went into the active rabbinate, before I came to Chicago, I was a congregational pulpit rabbi for over 35 years. There's always somebody in the congregation, especially American congregation, who's a Baal Machlekes. He's not just a gadfly. He's just an irritating gnat in the insect world. But he's always looking for something. He's a Baal Machlekes. And every American love especially has to be on the lookout for that fellow. And it's a fact. So no yamzik for Machlekes. You know, from somebody who say day, he'll say it's night. So there, however, according to the smock, it's a Isur D'Raisa. It's a prohibition, just like the Isur D'Raisa not to eat non-kosher or other things, or speak Lashon Hara, which this day and age has been twisted around in all different ways. So the same thing is, Lo Yadzi Vamach Lakers. Now when I was in yeshiva, unfortunately, we had the faculty of yeshiva, what we call the yeshiva department, is exactly the term what Rav Soloveitchik Zalman, I quoted at the Chag HaSmicha, the collection of Roshei Yeshiva that we had at that time in the 40s, the Rav said, and he yelled it out at the Chag HaSmicha, "Mir hoben die greste Rosh Yeshivas in the world." We have the greatest Rosh Yeshivas in the world. What he meant was that each Rosh Yeshiva was in himself could have had a special yeshiva. He was such a great Talmudic scholar. But at the same time, there was an innuendos of not agreement. Because if one went, there was always a question when he went for one shiur or the other. The Rosh Yeshiva would say, "How come you're not staying here? Well, what are you getting over there that you're not getting in my shiur?" That was either said directly or implied. And that was a part of the problem. So, in fact, each Rosh Yeshiva learned a different gemara, which was not true in all the other yeshivas or in Europe, where there was one Rosh Yeshiva, and that's what all the Talmidim that were in the yeshiva studied that masikta, they studied that tractate. But in our time, like I entered a class, there was a Rav Gorak Zal, who was a practicing Rav, but he was a Grand Talmudic scholar. So I entered, he was learning then the end of Masechta Gittin. Rav Palev was learning, I think, then was Masechta Beitzer. Rav Soloveitchik, it was the year when he really started full-time giving shiurim. He was learning Sanhedrin. And you had Rav Shatzker Zal, who had just come over from the Holocaust escape from Japan. He was learning another Masechta, he was learning the Dorim. And you had, and Dr. Belkin Zal, who was a very active Rosh Yeshiva. And I must add, Dr. Belkin, Zecheinu Levracha, they call him Dr. Belkin. He was a great Talmudic master. By the non-YU world, he's totally underrated. He was a godly in learning, just like any other Rosh Yeshiva of today. I would say he would outmatch any of them. His presentations of Hasbara, his clarification of halacha, and he learned the difficult, most difficult gemaras. Yavamis was one of his favorite. You ask anybody in Talmudic studies learning Yavamis, he gave over the shiurim and clearly, whatever he did. So I'm saying, I'm just giving an example of what was going on then. Later on, there were things were organized differently. When was there a upheaval in the yeshiva? When in the 40s, when they brought in a mashgiach into the yeshiva, a spiritual advisor. And when I came, there was no such thing as a mashgiach and an official position like there was in the Musar yeshivas of Europe. I'm saying the Musar yeshivas, which in itself in Europe was a great controversy, was a great machlekes. If you have the set of Svarim, Tenua Samusar, the movement of Musar written by Rav Dov Katz, which is a very authoritative and source book of all of the existence of the Musar movement, there's one volume that says Pulma Samusar, which means the polemic that existed in the yeshiva world in Lithuania, especially against Musar, for Musar. Well, that was a big machlekes. So here it was brought in, he was really a saintly man, Yankov Moshe Lesenzahl, who was a Slobodka Talmud of the great Mashgiach, Dr. Hirsch Finkelzahl, the Alter of Slobodka. He was there for many years. He was a practicing rabbi in Lithuania. And after the Holocaust, after losing a good part of his family, he came to America, and he became the Mashgiach of the yeshiva. So there was some opposition. In the college department, talking about Torah Mada, there was one professor that ranted and raved. I can't describe his ranting and raving about that they brought in a mashgiach of Musar, as if to say he's going to brainwash all of the fellows there. It was not true. The main thing I learned from that lesson was his conduct. His conduct of chesed, of kindness, and his being such a gentleman that he really affected me. I can give you one example. And I've mentioned that in Dorsons for many years. Once a group of us boys had to go and see the mashgiach, because he was in charge of passing out money and other things before Pesach, so that the boys could go home. Not any of us was too affluent, whatever it was. So waiting in line, there was a fellow there with his mother. Waiting in line was his mother. And he had a little office on the second floor of the main building with just a cubbyhole. He comes out and he sees the fellow waiting with his mother. He runs into his office, pulls out a chair. This very saintly looking man, he was a prince, the way he was dressed, spotless. He was straight, he walked straight, and everything, his appearance. He carried out a chair so that the lady could sit down. When I saw that, that's a very effective thing. Hey, he's not... He's with us, as a mensch. He's a real, what you say, a Musa person. That's the type of, and there were many other things that I used to see. And later on, when he retired in a place at Long Beach, I heard he used to carry a Yiddish newspaper to one of the old residents in the nursing home to be able to read the Yiddish press. So, I mean, that's part of the Musa. But there was a Machlekes. There was a argument that happened in the confines of yeshivas. There never was a machlekes whether it should be Torah or Mada, because everybody was studying the secular subjects or so forth, and whatever happened, happened. I found that later on in my going to college and receiving a BA degree, and I might as well add, I did cum laude, and my specialty was in languages, was in English and French, and I continued my Latin from high school. I began Greek. Yeah, well, one of the great professors of Greek there in the college, Dr. Bernard Floch. It was like a gong when it came to the classics and so forth. So I found that useful with the rabbinate. When I could give a glossa, I could give an analogy or a quote or something. It sort of fleshed out my sermons, my presentations,
other people.
But I think I'll stop now.
Thank you. Maybe you could share a little bit about why, for everyone to understand, why is disagreement part of a halachic tradition? Why is that part of the Jewish community's halachic tradition from time immemorial?
Genetic.
Machlokes, on some level, is probably the lifeblood of a Jew. pumps us up when we wake up in the morning. We try to think about what are the fights that we need to wage. When President Joel came to the yeshiva, so he articulated the slogan of ennoble and enable. And I came along with President Joel, brought me in, and I said, I'm going to inject a supplementary slogan of enrage and engage. Because the truth is that even the mission of Pirkei Avos talks about a constructive form of machlokes, what's referred to as machlokes l'shem shemayim. That we believe that from machlokes l'shem shemayim sofa l'hiskayim, there's such a thing as good machlokes, as a constructive dialogue that we have with each other when there are disagreements, in which we really do engage each other to arrive at a higher truth, to make progress in our communal lives. And the example that's given is the machlokes of Hillel v'Shammai. They both learned in the Beis Medrash, they both respected the same values and the same traditions, and through their dialogue that they were able to flesh out the truth of what the Torah desires from all of us. But that's contrasted with what's referred to as the negative tradition of machlokes, which is machlokes she'ena l'shem shemayim, which is not for the sake of heaven. How do you determine whether a disagreement is for the sake of heaven or not? So the Mishnah gives you a clue. It says the machlokes that was not for the sake of heaven was Korach ba'adaso, was Korach and his followers. And the obvious question is, wasn't his machlokes, wasn't the dispute with Moshe Rabbeinu? Why is Moshe Rabbeinu not mentioned? So I saw in the Torah Tamina's commentary on Pirkei Avos, which is called Baruch Sheomar, that he explains that what was wrong with Korach's machlokes was that he didn't engage Moshe Rabbeinu. It was only what he decided together with his followers to do without any kind of discussion, without any kind of constructive dialogue. That's the type of controversy that we should avoid. That's the type of controversy which is condemned as being what Rav Schwartz referred to as matzik b'machlokes, as perpetrating disagreement for the sake of generating strife. And that is ein sof l'hiskayim. Nothing positive comes from that type of a rift within the community. But what's extremely instructive, I believe, is the reaction of Moshe Rabbeinu to the destructive type of machlokes that was waged by Korach. Rather than simply dismissing them outright and adding fuel to the fire, Moshe actually reached out to them. Moshe approached them. By Shlach Moshe, the throw of the son of Aviram, he called for them, even though they gave him no respect whatsoever, and they were prepared to just run roughshod all over him. Nonetheless, he said, let's try to make peace. And Rashi there, on that passage, says, Shani Moshe, Mechazer Akareyem Vashlimam B'Zimrei Sholom. The Moshe's reaction was, let's try to work it out. You didn't go about this properly. You didn't consult properly. You didn't engage properly. But let's try to fix it. And I think that we, as a community, have the same obligation with respect to the sometimes improper and inappropriate machlokes that's waged within our midst. Sometimes it's not done in the proper environment of engaging, in the proper environment of constructive dialogue, in the proper environment of the Beis Medrash. We know that the Beis Medrash atmosphere allows for very fierce debate. That is our tradition of Seder Mokamos Hashem. When we're fighting over what the Seder, what the Seder means, it can be a Mokamah. That's called Mokamta Shotor. But the end result, we're told, is Esfahet Besufa. That in the end, it generates Ahava. When it's done in the confines of the Beis Medrash, when it's done in the right type of respectful atmosphere, where everybody is playing by the rules, then it does lead to a positive and to a harmonious conclusion. When that's not the case, then it is our responsibility to try to make it harmonious, to try to engage in that type of a dialogue, to try to keep everybody within the fold, to try to remind the broader community about what the values are that bind us and unite us. Because the forces that unite us, generally speaking, are much more powerful than the forces that divide us. And I think that our attitude has to be that until there is a complete lack of reciprocity and receptiveness, we have to do our utmost to maintain the unity of our community and to engage in this type of a constructive and this type of a sensitive and thoughtful dialogue by simply bringing everyone together and having frank and honest discussions about all of the issues that people are concerned about. I had this bliss of being at Yeshiva this past Shabbos, since Yeshiva was sending along President Joel and Lord Rabbi Jonathan Sachs and Rabbi Blau. They figured they had to negotiate a trade, so I was there.
He was equal to the three of us.
I was asked to speak about the issue of women's communal roles within the community, which is a very sensitive, hot-button issue. But I spoke about it during the Shalosh Shuras presentation. I was able to be very open-minded because it wasn't being recorded. And the major point that I tried to make with the Talmidim was that just because an issue is difficult doesn't mean that we should run away from it. And it doesn't mean that we can't speak about how there are gray areas and how there are complicated areas and how sometimes there aren't easy answers. Even having that discussion itself enables us to be able to gain the respect of a much broader group of individuals within our community. And we have to role model in the way in which we speak, with the respect in which we show those even who are in disagreement with us, the way in which we have this type of constructive conversation within our tradition. And if that is the case and we do this properly, then I truly believe that it will be so far the hiskayeh, that we will ensure that a positive result will ensue, and that we will be able also to maintain as large as possible a population of adherence to our tradition within our Orthodox community for the future.
Okay, thank you.
Just for me.
Could add something to the reasons talking about the question of Machlokes with Shana Beis Hillel. There's a Mishnah in Chagiga about Tezayin Amud Aleph, which mentions the Machlokes having to do with the laws of Yontif and the Beis Hamikdash. Whether there's a halacha of smicha, of laying on the hands on the korban before bringing it to sacrifice. Well, can you do that on Yom Tov? Not supposed to deal with animals on Yom Tov and so forth without going into all of the ramifications. So it says that from the time of the Zugos, Yossi ben Yezer, and later on, and his rival at that time, one said Lismo, one said Shalom Lismo, one said you should be able to do it on Yom Tov, one said you could not. So the Balitesis quoted Yerushalmi, Talmud Yerushalmi, and say that that was the first Machlekes in Torah Shabbat. Up to that time, there was no Machlekes. So Tesis asked questions on that. There were actually understood Machlekes in the time of the Nevi'im, whatever it was, but this answer was there, they had a haklor. They came to an agreement, so the Machlekes ended. This was an ongoing Machlekes, so Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel is continual. You go through all of Shishu Mishnah and other things, you have enumerated the debate between Shammai, Beis Shammai, and Beis Hillel, or between the personalities of Shammai and Hillel. In fact, there's a misreading, and this is the way the Bali Musa would read the text in Shabbos. Le'olam ye'odom anvason ke'hillel v'hi'kabdon ke'shammai. A person should be as humble and modest as Hillel and shouldn't be that kabdon, in other words, a question of angry or particular like Shammai. So that seems to imply the the maskilim, those who looked at the Talmud as some sort of a type of literary text, they said, well, Hillel had a good nature and Shammai had a bad nature. So the Bali Musa wouldn't read it that way, because the Gemara is not trying to teach us something about the nature of people, so to speak. They're trying to teach us a way of behavior. Meaning this, there's some people that, when it comes to observing of Yiddishkeit, they're very strong in their kabdonus. They're very demanding, very exacting, and they express it that way. That was a shita, that was an approach. Truth, Shammai wasn't a bad person, but that was his approach. But Hillel had a different approach. He was a softer, a kinder approach, but not because by nature he was that. So that's an important point that has to be remembered. The whole problem mainly in all machlekes is what happens to the rhetoric, the name calling. People lose track of the reason for machlekes. It becomes argumentum ad hominem. Here's our Latin phrase. They blame the person, you're this, you're that. You see that in the election campaigns now going on. They call each other names. What they're finding out, you're this and you're that, you're no good and so forth. That has no place in Torah. And there's an interesting little note that I took from the Chuvas of the Noyed Yehuda. Rabbi Yecheskel Landau was one of the great poskim of the 18th century, the Rav of Prague, world famous up to this day. So he was involved in a very severe dispute about the kashrus of a fish, a certain type of fish which is identified called shtiru. Some think it's a type of a sturgeon. What kind of sturgeon? We're not going into that. So he said it's kosher, and there's the whole reasoning there based on the interpretation of the Ramban and Chumash about the scales coming off, or whether it can come off through soaking in hot water, not just by peeling them off, and so forth. And others opposed it. So later on, his son, who continues some of his tshuvas, Rabbi Shmuel Landau, he gives actually a type of a response to one of the rabbanim who came out. He was Mari Shalomos. He said that this is fake, this is not kosher, and he made a great tumult. So the son says that if you're involved in a machlekes, you have to show respect. Even if you don't agree, see the language of that tshuva, it's in the Madura Tinyana of the Nevi Yehuda, and it's written by the son. That's a Simin Chotes. If anyone looks at the last paragraph, he tells them that's not the way the language that should be used, especially to his father, who was one of the Gedolei Hador, and Hetzel Landau was a great Pesach, was involved in many, many controversies. But to use disrespectful language, even if you disagree, and they're talking about whether it's kosher or not kosher, you still have to be respectful. And that's the problem that we have a lot today. People are name-calling. They immediately say, he's an apocryphalist, he's an unbeliever, he went off the road, or so forth. People have to be careful in their language and their rhetoric. That's the problem that we have today, and happened in other times. But again, today it's quite persistent.
The President referenced before the difference between the tent and the tarp. So how does the yeshiva navigate putting down poles related to that boundary?
One of the great concerns when I was selected as the fourth president is he's not a rabbi, and therefore what's going to happen? And as Rav Schwartz indicated, there was never a time where there was one person who said, this is the way there is, there were rabbanim. And they would discuss with each other and they would decide. I'd also want to say, if I just can put in an advertisement, so of the four people on this panel, There's one of them.
There are three people. I'm just.
There's one of them.
Just be clear.
There's one of them who did not go to Yeshiva University, and that's me. And thank God, all of Esther and my six children all have gone to Yeshiva University. One is a Rav. But look at these three, and look at their midos, and look at the wealth of Torah, and ask where Rav Schwartz learned Latin, and then look at your children and grandchildren.
Of course, learned it in Southside High School.
That's not what I'm saying. That's why high school is so important. And say, look at their bearing, look at the scope of their knowledge, look at how they're intent on applying that knowledge to today, and look at how they carry themselves, and should our children and grandchildren be any less? And what do we have to do to invest in our children that way? At Yeshiva, look, the challenge of the Big Tent is that we're not all going to agree. And when we have machlokes, we're not all going to be together. And we can't necessarily all say, Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim. We believe that some thoughts within our community go beyond Pesach. So our yeshiva is bounded. Yes, we have 26 different Rosh and yeshiva. I hold 2 days Yom HaTzmaut. We have multiple places where our students light candles because our Rabbeim don't agree on where you can light candles on Hanukkah. But it's beautiful. I had a conversation with Rav Schachter, clearly the senior Rosh Yeshiva, and we were talking about whether he should be Rosh HaYeshiva. And he said, absolutely not. I said, why? He said, 2 reasons. If I was Rosh Yeshiva, I'd have to muzzle myself. This way, if I say something, you can say he doesn't speak for the yeshiva. Nobody believes me, but I can say it. He said, but the other thing is, he says, this yeshiva's never had a Rosh HaYeshiva, whoever had the title. He said, the beauty of it is it's not a family yeshiva. The beauty of it is that there are many different perspectives within Torah. We all share certain perspectives, but we also disagree, and that's important for our students to learn. And it is, but it's confusing. The boundaries of the tent is Pesach and our poskim. There's lots of talk now around, and since I have no qualifications to speak to this, I can do so with authority. There are all these questions. After all, a rabbi can say whatever he wants. I agree with that. I believe we give smicha for young people not to build anew, but to build upon. But to build upon. And I think we have to stress that. And I also think my musmachim are better than any musmachim that ever came out of our yeshiva or any yeshiva. But they're general practitioners. And they should serve that way as general practitioners. But if you go to a GP and your heart is hurting and he says, lie down, we're going to do open heart surgery, you might want another opinion. And also in Torah, we have to find ways to look for expertise and to resolve these. And like constitutional law, the law is not always the same in each district. That what was in Minsk wasn't always in Pinsk. But there is no Minsk in Pinsk today. There's internet. And therefore, everything can argue with everything. And the other issue is, things evolve over time, and sometimes they don't. And we have to deal with those issues. So there are two pieces to it that I need to just say in talking about what our yeshiva is, but more than that, what our community is. Recognizing that we don't live alone. There's a community in Jewishness that says the world is corrupt, therefore we're going to live by ourselves. We'll live a good life, and in the zechus of our good life, Mashiach will come. Our basic notion is to be like Avram and Sarah, not like Noah, and to be out there and work and take the good from the world and also know how not to the things that are. But we're in a culture that we're stuck in. And often it's one of snarling and anger. There are two pieces. One is to represent that we're Orthodox. That doesn't mean that everything can be. It means that we have different levels. I think we have failed tremendously in our community in doing anything except yelling no. We speak out when we're going to say what we're opposed to. And we don't speak out lovingly, explaining ourselves, explaining our principles. By the way, even to ourselves. My kids completely buy into all of this. And they'll ask me a question. They'll say, you know, we have to rely on the poskim. Who are the poskim? Present company, except. Who are the poskim? What makes them poskim? We know how the Supreme Court is appointed. Who are the poskim? And why do you need poskim? And what's the power of psak? And how is it decided? Now, in the walls of our yeshiva, it's taken for granted or known. But I have to tell you, many of the people in our yeshiva who take it for granted, take it for granted out of ignorance, our students. Because it's a given. We must speak to those issues. We must explain. It's time. It's past time. We also have to be able to say, don't just say no. Let's talk about what we are, what we believe, what's good. And as Rav Schwartz said, equally important, when we answer, and if we're saying no, a lot of people can accept that. But if the no comes with derogatory language, with vilification, with put-downs, with people feeling free to make statements on the internet that they could justify narrowly, but really give an impression of broader condemnation, we are all belittled. And just like the Balei Musar, and just like Rav Lessons at Zichrono Livracha, we have to conduct them. We have a burden and an obligation, a sacred obligation, to conduct ourselves with menschlichkeit and with decency. Not necessarily agreeing with everything. We can't. We shouldn't. But to do it with pleasantness. Was that what you asked?
Rabbi Reis, could perhaps a few moments to explain a little bit more in terms of who decides and how decisions are made when it comes to machlokas, different opinions?
I'd say, actually. So. come to me and we have a principle of Eilu be'Eilu, Zikrei Elokim Chayim, that each of those are the words of the living God. And the question is, does that mean that everybody has a vote, that everybody has an opinion? So I'll tell you something which will be perhaps a very courageous statement to make, which is, yeah, meaning I think everybody does. I think the nature of our tradition is that the Kesef Torah, the Kramer Torah, really isn't just available to everybody. But the weight which is given to every single opinion might not be identical. Those who were qualified to sit in the Sanhedrin had a greater degree of authority than the Talmidim and the students who were training and were sitting in the rows in front of the Sanhedrin. And the students who were sitting in the rows training in front of the Sanhedrin had a greater measure of authority than those who were working it out in the fields who may not have been so learned. But it was very important to hear everybody's opinion because everybody has a place in the Torah. It's just necessary for us to qualify and to quantify what the different roles of different individuals are when we have this great debate, when we have this great discussion with each other. The Gemara talks about Dariki. Dariki was an affectionate term that was used by the great rabbis when a rabbi in training would make a very bold assertion that wasn't supported according to halakha. And the elder rabbi would say, Dariki, you're a very sweet Ziskai. You're a Talmud, you're a student, and I expect great things from you, but the Talmud should die in the year of Allah. Your student who still hasn't reached quite that same high level as your masters. There's such a notion of being a Rashi, of reaching that point in which you receive the certification to have a vote in the final tally of what should be permitted and what should be prohibited. Who decides whether you have reached that Higiyah L'Horah stage? So it's always been the great rabbis from generation to generation. There's a reason why if you open up a sefer, you look at the haskamas. Haskamas don't mean, and I've learned this since I began to be asked to give haskamas, so I can tell you, it doesn't mean that the person really read the sefer, necessarily. But what it means is that, you know, maybe they and make sure that the author is outrageous there, but that the author is being certified as somebody who is sufficiently yield ahora that he can write, that he can teach about Torah principles. And some will say that these are rabbis whom we trust, and we see that the rabbis whom we trust are giving a certification to the continuation of the transmission of Mesorah. And it's always been the same way, even with respect to opening up the yeshiva. We ask the question, who are the great masters whom we have trusted, who have given the authorization, who have given the certification for this yeshiva? You have to ask that question. Those are the types of questions that I've learned to ask over the years. When it comes to a smicha, who has given the smicha? Is the person who has given the smicha somebody who we rely upon as a Baal Torah, somebody we rely upon as one of the great Torah giants of our community? Everybody is worthy of respect. That goes without question. Everybody is part of this Elu B'Elu. But the question is, what are the roles that are appropriate for different individuals to play? And that goes to the transmission of our Mesorah. Who is vouching for their authority? Our tradition very much depends upon the notion of Moshe Kikla Torah Misinai Masra LeYoshua, of the transmission from generation to generation of the Torah greats. Of Chaim Soloveitchik to Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik to Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik to Rav Herschel Schaffer, to Rabbi Mordechai Mullig, to Rav Yedaya Dov Schwartzschlita, and it continues in that vein. And that's very much how we can be guided in terms of knowing where to turn and to resolve the disagreements and the difficult questions within our community.
So maybe then I could follow up for a moment with Rav Schwartz. So on one hand, there is Elu ve'Elu. On the other hand, there are limits to a halachic community. So how does a halachic community relate to another community beyond the halacha, to a conservative, a non-orthodox, reform congregation, clergy, community? If we're engaged in the world, if we're engaged in that dialogue, how do we relate to a non-halachic community?
First of all, I'd like to mention something which is important in learning Chumash. There's a series of oral curses. So one of the curses there, it says, cursed is the one that does not uphold, it doesn't say does not do, does not uphold this Torah. So Ramban, who is one of the greatest Mefarshim and Poskim that we have in the rabbinic world, in the Torah world, analyzes, and he brings also a Yerushalmi, it doesn't say, or asher lo yaseh. Cursed is one that does not observe. In other words, there are a lot of our non-observant Jews out there, and so forth. They're not under the aura. They're not under the curse of not observing the Torah. But who is under that? The one that does not uphold the principle. In other words, there could be a non-observant person, used as an example, Lahabdul, I've heard people say, what's your religion? So a person would say, I'm a Catholic. Do you go to Mass? Or not? No, I don't. So how come you're... But he said, that's what I believe in. I mean, that's the way I was trained. I'm just not observant. But he doesn't try to distort the principles of his faith or so forth. Now, if somebody comes, like what used to happen, and I came in the 50s, I don't think people really realize when a young fledgling Musmuch entered the rabbinate in the early 1950s, the world was dominated in the American scene by the conservative movement, the rabbinate. I was told by people, why are you wasting your time in yeshiva and getting smicha? What kind of congregation are you going to find? First of all, the pay is no good. In fact, the only type of basic congregation that existed where a young rabbi could go in the far out place where a bunch of disgruntled balabati who were originally from Europe didn't have too much respect for this young rabbi, or however they pronounced it, and the pay was awful. I used to say the community service division, what the American order congregation want, they want a reformed rabbi for the price of an Orthodox one. That's what they want. And that was true. It was awesome. But you're faced at that particular time to try to overcome that. But you have to reach out to the non-observant people, younger people that came into your shul. You have to address that. When I started the rabbinate in Providence, Rhode Island, my drushes on Shabbos, because who attended the shul? 30, 40 Jews, that their major language was Yiddish. So my sermons were Yiddish. Shabbos morning, I'll be good Yiddish, a Yiddish drusha, the whole drusha. When there was a bar mitzvah, there was an uproof, there were the Yom Kippur and the holidays, I spoke in English today. But I used to teach the Talmud, the Gemara class, there in Providence in Yiddish, and the Chumash class in Yiddish, and Ein Yaker between Mech and Meiru in Yiddish. It was a different world, but the world was dominated by conservatives. However, at that time, once there was a discussion, a presentation, that had to be made between what is the faith of conservative rabbi, reform rabbi, and orthodox rabbi. So the conservative rabbi at that time was a very nice fellow. He was a, you know, a Beinol Machaber. I was good friends with him. We never went to war. In fact, he said, our religion, that's what he described it. Conservatism is a religion of convenience. It's convenient for you to ride to shul on Shabbos, go right ahead. If it's convenient for you to eat non-kosher, go right ahead. We don't stop you. He said, I eat in Chinese restaurants, but I only eat fish. We didn't know what's going on there in the kitchen, or so forth. Whatever it was. And he said, if I'm together with Rabbi Schwartz under the chuppah, he says, we don't have an argument about anything. I let him do the Siddur Kedushin, and I maybe give a speech. So we had sort of an agreement. We were not at war. The reform just threw out the whole, all of Yiddishkeit, whatever it has. It was a bunch of platitudes being nice to somebody else. But you had all types of people. Some were nasty and some were not. And some were very, belligerent. So just like in the Orthodox world, in Europe, there were belligerent rabbonim. One of the most famous that even by the fourth elements in Poland didn't like him because he was a munkach. But Chaim Arnozel Shapiro Zal was a god, a great rabbinic master in munkach, but he was against every type of movement and he used sharp rhetoric. One of his famous rhetorics was told by somebody who studied in his Talmud Torah. It says Yerushalayim was destroyed Kamsa bar Kamsa. Who's Kamsa? That's the name of a person. He had a Rosh HaTeva, it's an abbreviation. The Kuf stands for communism. The Mem stands for Mizrachism. The Tzadik stands for Zionism. And the Aleph is Agudism. Everyone he knows. In fact, he attacked the Ger Rebbe, who went to visit in Eretz Yisrael the first time. He visited Rav Kook. The Ger Rebbe, the head of the huge empire of Hasidim in Poland, who were not Zionists, he went to pay respects to Rav Kook. So he attacked him. So the head of the Agudas Rabbonim in Poland, the Ger Rebbe, son-in-law, said we have to make a machor protest against the disrespect he showed to the Ger Rebbe. I'm just saying, it's the rhetoric, how you deal with people. When I took my first position there in Providence, somebody in Newark, from my old hometown, said, you have a minion of Shermer Shabbos? Who's talking about Shermer Shabbos? Lucky to have one person that was a Shermer Shabbos, a real one. There was one or two people, the rest were not. He says, how could you have a minion? You have to be, because there was an approach. And it's brought in halacha, it's a debate, that's part of a debate. Can you count the non-Shermer Shabbos in a minion? That's where Machlokes could break out. And some people say, I'm not going to dominate you. You're not form enough for me. So this is not the approach that we have reached out to American Jewry. That people today don't realize what it means. There are one today that come into a shul that has a mechitza, has a bima, has already a Gemara shir and so forth. They never knew what it was to start all of this from the beginning, to fight to maintain the mechitza in order not to destroy it. I had to go through that experience. And what is worst of all, that's a subject for another lecture, revisionist Jewish history in America. And who accomplished what and who was the pioneer in this, and so forth. There's such changes of the facts, it's unbelievable. And I could attest to it, I could prove that many of the facts that are the triumphalism by certain groups, what is called even by the Navi Yehuda's son, Koyach HaNetzuach, that you win, you have to win the Machlokes. You have to come out on top, even if you're going to twist the truth or call somebody else different names.
So, okay, before President Joel gets back on the plane to New York, we'll ask him to just take one last item, which is, so moving forward, every generation we've had Machlokes, every generation we've had differences of opinion that has been articulated. What are some of the things that we should be mindful of as we try to chart the course moving forward?
I found it easier to be me in the broader Jewish community beyond the Orthodox. I found it easier to deal with machlokes by acknowledging profound basic differences. And my colleagues would honor that and agree to that. I'd be very careful not to delegitimize their views, but say, we believe there's a schism here. We have to deal with that. Or not deal with that. But it doesn't mean that we can't find areas where we can be one. There can't be. I think it's incredibly important that we maintain a Knesset Israel. Whether someone is going to marry my child or someone else, that's an issue that we have to deal with. But that there has to be a community. I must tell you, I find that easier in dealing with my Reform and Conservative colleagues. I think, moving forward, we really have to have rules of engagement. We are going to disagree, even within our tent. But if we're going to remain within the tent, I do believe we have to understand halacha and psak and poskim and authority. I don't mean it's all there and we have to explain it. I think we have to delve into it. And I think it has to be explained. It's not a concession to explain. We owe it to our children to do that. I also think sometimes we have to accept that everything isn't okay. But if it's not okay, you don't delegitimize the other person. Sometimes you agree to disagree. And you don't have to say, I'm right and you're right. I think you can say, I'm right, I think you're wrong. I'll say one last story and then I'll close. When I was in Hillel, when I was being brought to yeshiva, one of the kindness everybody had is they heard that I was a pluralist. How could a pluralist be the president of the Jewish university? And I said, it's interesting because it depends on the definition of pluralism. We are living in a time of relativism where because there is a liberal world, and I don't use that as a bad word, there is a sense of we're all okay. One of the issues I have with my university presidents, they say, Richard, it's easy for you. You can say, here are the values, here are the boundaries. We can only talk about diversity because you're okay and I'm okay and you're okay. It's a culture of relativism. So when I was at Hillel, so I'm a firm guy, I had a wonderful friend, Rabbi Dan Bridge, who was the rabbi at the University of Washington Hillel. He was a left-wing Reform rabbi. I know that something happened at Harsina. I know there were kolot ubrakim. I know that the kol demama daka of God came out. And the Torah was given, the Aseres HaDibros. My friend, who is the Hillel director, who was the Hillel director at University of Washington, thinks nothing happened at Sinai. Nothing. Well, you know what? We can't both be right. Either it happened or it didn't happen. But I don't have to spend my life in a death struggle with that guy. I'm able to say my definition of pluralism. It's incumbent upon me to honor and respect your right to be wrong. To be wrong. Pluralism has to be tolerance. It's not relativism. And we're not very good at that. And certainly the other side isn't necessarily very good at accepting that definition. We need to raise people to realize that there are mitzvos bein adam l'makom and bein adam l'chavero, and you don't choose between one another. You figure out how to integrate them. That's ultimately bein adam la'atzmo. Are you an integrated person? Have you gone to Yeshiva University so you learn how to be shalom? I think that's our challenge for the future. We must approach it with an enormous amount of patience, with an enormous amount of understanding, and with an enormous amount of being unyielding in terms of what we know to be true.
So, in conclusion, where I started, which was with Hakaras HaTov. First of all, Hakaras HaTov to Rav Schwartz, Shalitza, to Rabbi Reis, Shalitza, for taking the time, to President Joel for coming, spending Shabbos with us. But the truth is, the greatest thank you goes to Yeshiva. If it wouldn't be for Yeshiva University, what would our community look like? What would our rabbinic landscape look like? What would our balabatim look like? So many of us in this room, our children or grandchildren. And we have to take this opportunity, as before we walk out, to realize not only is Yeshiva grappling with, addressing, and cultivating the core issues that are facing our community now, but they're investing in us and our community. So even though we're not in the tri-state area, we're not even that side.
But you were. Not New York is a wonderful place.
But we recognize how much we owe, how much of a debt of gratitude we owe to Yeshiva University, to the leadership of Yeshiva University, and how much we appreciate that and have invested in our community. And we look forward to coming together to continue to strengthen our community and Jewish life in general. Yes, Shabbat. Thank you.
It's so lonely. It's funny. Yeah, how do you know? But,